Welcome to the Influential Women Podcast, the podcast that brings you achingly human conversations with fascinating women as we talk about their personal lives and their influences. This is Nikki Bannerman, and my influential woman today is Claire McIntosh. Hello and welcome, Claire.
Hi, Nikki.
Lovely to meet you. And you've travelled all the way down or up from Wales?
Very much down. I have. I live in North Wales, so right up in the Snowdonia National Park.
Wow, what a beautiful place to be. Very inspiring for your work. Now, Claire McIntosh is a crime fiction writer, a columnist, a journalist, and a former policewoman and criminal investigator. So, Claire, you took your passion for solving crime to a voyage of writing discovery. Tell us about that.
I did, although it wasn't a deliberate journey, or at least if it was, I wasn't quite clear about my destination at the time. It was 2011, and I was working as a public order commander, as an inspector in the police force, working very long hours. I had three small children. I'd been through a very difficult time having those children. I had a bit of an epiphany. I was looking towards my chief inspector promotion. I did a sort of an assessment. It's called a 360 degree assessment, where you send out a questionnaire to your bosses, your peers, your team. They fill it out anonymously and send it back, and you end up with an overview of what you're like as a person to work with. It said how I was always ready to listen. I had an open door. I was always happy and, you know, good humoured. And he looked at it and he said, "Yeah, this is great. Who's this woman?" And I realised that I'd been using all the best bits of me for my job and giving my family the leftovers. So I took a career break, took a 2-year career break. To the children were just, my eldest was about to start school. The twins, a year younger than him, would be starting the next autumn. And I thought, I'll take 2 years, I'll settle the children into school, and then, you know, we'll see. But in the meantime, I had to earn money. And the only thing I knew how to do, apart from policing, was to write. So I wrote. I started with journalism and copywriting. I wrote social media content. I wrote about anything that anyone would pay me to write about. And at the same time, I started writing fiction.
And it worked incredibly. Do you think you need to be nearly as brave writing for a living as you do solving crime on the streets?
Oh, I think you have to be braver. I think you have to be very brave to take that jump from a comfortable job to a freelance job, any kind of freelance job, and certainly freelance writing, whether you're writing novels or copywriting or whatever, is really quite a precarious profession. And so there's bravery in that. There's also a bravery in bearing your soul, because whether you're writing about your own life or whether you're writing, you're creating fictional characters, you're still giving people insight into a part of you that they don't normally see. And that's a terrifying experience.
Terrifying, but also very helpful to a lot of other women out there. And we'll come on to that, because you said you changed from the family being suffered from mood swings and burnt suppers, and now it's all changed. But your first book you touched on, I Let You Go, it debuted in 2011 and talked about a hit-and-run tragedy of a young boy being killed. Now, this had an element of truth, didn't it, with the unsolved crime you'd worked on that really moved you?
It did. This hit-and-run happened, and it sent shockwaves through the whole community. And I really struggled to understand how anybody could drive away from the scene of a road traffic accident like that, where you knew that someone had been hurt and later that you knew a child had been killed. So I struggled with that. I struggled with how a mother could survive after losing a child. I was very young. I was 21. And it just seemed inconceivable that one could survive that. And at the time, I had no idea that 10 years later, I'd lose my own child in very different circumstances. And so the young me just couldn't comprehend how somebody kept going after that.
That's what I was going to ask you about, you know, whether you wanted to talk about that, because that is an incredibly painful experience you went through, but you've used that experience that's helped yourself and helping others.
I never set out to write something that was cathartic or therapeutic, either for myself or anyone else. But certainly when I was writing I Let You Go, which is very much a study in grief as much as anything else, there were, of course, a lot of elements of my own experience that went into it. And those sections, those chapters, were incredibly hard to write, painful to write at times. But I think that as a society, we don't talk very much about the loss of children. There's no name for us, for mothers who have lost children. We're not widows, orphans. We're still mothers, and yet our children aren't there. And it's a very particular type of grief, which actually doesn't lessen as time goes by, because every passing year is just another reminder of the person that isn't there. And it doesn't lessen with more children. Having other children doesn't make up for a child that you've lost. It gives you a reason to keep going, but it can't ever take away the pain.
Gosh, very brave. And very brave, you know, you talking about it. It's really, really very moving. You described it literally as your salvation and dedicated and devoted your first book to Alex. That's really beautiful.
Yeah, I don't know who else I would have dedicated that book to, really. I think the memory of him and what we'd been through was so much a part of the writing of that book, and my experiences of losing him really fueled the emotion behind it and made the book as intense as it ended up being. So yeah, the book was for Alex.
And you've had women that have written to you and said, that's exactly what I felt, the way I couldn't describe it, and I've shown that to my family, and that's actually helped me move forward, haven't you? You've had people saying that.
I have. I'm overwhelmed by the number of people who get in touch with authors, almost always saying lovely things, sometimes not, but that's fine too. But I think it's great that anyone takes time out of their day to write to authors, because, you know, we don't get to talk to that many people. But I've had a lot of emails from women who have lost children, and it's something that actually I've experienced for a very long time, because before I wrote I Let You Go and before I left the police, I was blogging, and I was quite a prolific parent blogger, and I blogged extensively about grief and child bereavement, postnatal depression, a lot of very emotional issues. And the letters that I had, the emails that I had from women who told me that my blog posts had resonated with them, were really the first time that I'd realized the power of words, and that I could sometimes put things in a way that made sense to people. And so it was a really inspiring period of my life, because it was really instrumental in that transition from just writing for me to writing for an audience.
Well, and a huge audience you've got. I mean, translated into 30 languages, is it?
I think about 40 now.
Oh my goodness, she says modestly. And sold over 1 million copies worldwide?
Yeah, I Let You Go is sold a million. Yeah, and I See You is on track to do even better, actually, which is astonishing, because of course I had that second fear that lots of authors talk about, where you've had, you know, if you've been fortunate enough to have a very successful debut, there's then an absolute terror that you won't be able to do it again. And so it's been a big relief that I See You's been so well received.
Gosh, I think they're all hungry for more. And did you know that true crime is a massive subject on podcasts?
I did know. Of course, everyone loves Making a Murderer and Serial and all sorts of things like that.
So from your experience, you became patron of the Silver Star charity, supporting other families and the John Radcliffe's hospital work with people facing difficult pregnancies, as you mentioned.
Yeah, so the Silver Star Society supports a very particular unit at the hospital where I had my children. And it's they support parents who have high-risk pregnancies, difficult pregnancies, gestational diabetes, premature delivery, all sorts of complications that one has during pregnancy. And I went through them with both my twin pregnancies. So I had a set of IVF twins in 2006 who were born very premature. They were born at 27 weeks. And my son, Alex, who we spoke about earlier, was 5 weeks old when he died. He contracted meningitis when he was was in hospital. So subsequently to that, I fell naturally pregnant then with a second set of twins, and there was a very high risk of early delivery. So the Silver Star unit kept me on track and enabled me to go home with two healthy babies, which was not something I ever thought I would see. So I'm really, really happy to give just a small amount of my time now to support them and tell people about what they do. Because a lot of the equipment that they raise money for are things that aren't considered to be essential services that the NHS can afford to buy. And I'm really, really privileged to help support them.
Lovely that you're giving back after you've been through such a lot. My goodness. Have you got any tips for other people facing difficult situations in their own lives, how they bounce back?
Do you know what? It's such a personal thing, isn't it? I remember talking to my midwife in the days after my second set of twins had been born, and I was really struggling to bond. And she was a very wise, slightly older lady, and she just said, "You don't have to enjoy this, you just have to survive it. And once you survive it, you'll get to a point where you realise that you're living again, and then you'll realise you're enjoying life again." But it's a gradual process. And I think that that's really important to remember, that you're not going to go from 0 to 60. You can't just get over it, whatever it is. You just have to keep getting up each day and keep taking a breath and keep putting one foot in front of another, and take every, people say take every day as it comes. Sometimes I think you have to take every hour, every minute as it comes. Give yourself a pat on the back for getting through that minute and that hour, because sometimes life is really, really tough.
That's good advice for people out there as well. It's getting through it, isn't it, rather than getting over it.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, your books weren't the romantic comedy you intended then. It was really drawn to the darker side of life. The psychological thrillers and dramas, they're really in demand, though, aren't they? And it's women that are consuming them, isn't it? They find them compelling. They're very in demand, aren't they?
They are. Crime and psychological thrillers have always been popular. And it is actually, it's always women who read. You know, women read far more fiction than men. Men read a lot more non-fiction. And men often will read perhaps on holiday, or they'll have a dedicated reading time, whereas women who love to read will read anywhere. You know, they'll always have a book in their bag, they'll read a couple of chapters before bed, you know.
Good perspective, and with your police force hat on, that probably gives a different view. So not only as an influential woman did you have three children under 15 months, but your second book, I see you've enjoyed the magic of editing and the feeling of being watched. Where does that come from?
Right. So I See You, my second book, is very much about being watched. And it's a feeling that I find really unsettling. I'm not alone in feeling unsettled. I was talking to my husband quite a while ago now about how I used to carry my keys poking between my fingers as I'm walking home from a pub. You know, I don't tend to walk home very, very many places on my own nowadays. And he looked at me in absolute sort of disbelief. You know, why on earth would you hold your keys through your fingers? And I said, well, obviously, in case I get attacked. And he was totally floored and said, but why would you get attacked? I said, but because that's what happens, and because I'm a woman and every one of my female friends has carried their keys through their fingers or known where their hairspray is in their bag or had some kind of strategy for what they would do if they were attacked. And I said, do you not feel like that if you were walking back perhaps from a pub late at night, you know, down an alleyway? And he said, no, it just wouldn't occur to me. And that's the real fundamental difference about our fears between men and women. And so it is a book that's written very much with that in mind. It came about when I was travelling to London with a friend of mine who commutes daily. And we were standing on the train platform and she moved me about 2 meters to the left, because if we stood in that specific spot, then that's where the train doors would open when the train arrived. And sure enough, it did. We slipped straight into empty seats, whereas other people had to stand. We got off the train, off the underground, and instead of going out the marked exit, we walked down the platform and snuck through all these little tiny shortcuts that she knew like the back of her hand. And I looked around and there were so many commuters who were just sort of walking in a bubble, doing the same thing they do every single day. And I thought, if we're that predictable, then that puts us in huge, huge danger. Because if you know what you're doing tomorrow, then someone else knows it too and can use it against you.
So is it the emotional side of the crimes that you've solved and putting those feelings into the novels, that intense emotion and experience that you enjoy?
Yes, I think so. It's certainly what I remember the most. If I think back to my police career, the jobs that stand out are the ones where I felt a really human connection. And so they might not have been the most exciting crimes or the most complicated investigations, but they were ones where the impact on the victims or the witnesses or sometimes the offender was so great that I couldn't fail but take it away with me.
Well, that's amazing. That's what gives that sort of extra passion to your work, isn't it? Now, your writing has been described as, I've got some adjectives here, grippy, captivating, addictive, chilling, sinister, genius, deeply unsettling, and so clever, and saying exactly what others are thinking and feeling, as we touched upon before. How does that feel? How would you describe your writing?
Wow. Well, I mean, that's amazing. I think, to be fair, you've chosen the good adjectives. I mean, I'm sure there are a few in there that aren't as complimentary somewhere. It is really incredible to hear that. It all feels slightly surreal. How would I describe my writing? I think just honest. I write in the way that I write. I don't presume to use a particular style. I don't try and be anyone else. I don't really search for different words. I just write the way it comes out, and it's gratifying that people like it.
And that's what's so authentic, isn't it? And they love it. So can we talk about where your other passions are then? How do you relax?
I hate this question because it makes me realise how few hobbies I have. I was talking to a friend of mine recently about how when you're young, you have hobbies and you do your French class or your German class and you learn how to describe your hobbies. And I said to her, do you have any hobbies? And she sort of thought, she said, don't. And so I wonder if it is a sort of a something that happens as you get older, that you don't have hobbies and quite the same way. However, I run and I swim. So running for me is about keeping fit. It's completely boring. I don't love it. I do it so that I can drink wine and eat biscuits and stay relatively healthy. But swimming is headspace. And I only really discovered it recently. So I couldn't really swim. It panicked me to have my head underwater. And so when I had children and the children were learning to swim, this became slightly ridiculous. So slowly I started to make myself get over this. And it was a genuine, you know, I wouldn't call it a phobia, but a real fear. You know, even in the shower, I wouldn't put my face in the water. So I started making myself go lower and lower into the water, making myself blow bubbles under the water, you know, just gradually working up to it, and eventually got to a point where I could swim properly. So it was a sort of a personal hurdle I needed to get over.
There you are. So you have got a hobby, and that's so good for you as well. What's been the proudest moment of your career?
You know what? I think I've got to go right back to the beginning. When I Let You Go was printed, I was invited to the printers to see it come off the line. And actually, I feel quite emotional just thinking back to it. It's indescribable, really, just how it feels to stand in the middle of this enormous factory and everywhere see my book, you know, printing the cover and the pages going off the line and it being bound and cut, and then just hundreds, thousands and thousands of copies going along a line all around my head. It was totally overwhelming. I was in floods of tears, happy, happy tears. And there were all these lovely burly men in high-vis jackets that were frankly bemused at why this woman was crying at this, you know, momentous happy day. But it was a real a visual reminder, I suppose, of what an amazing thing I'd done, because, you know, lots of people start books and not as many people finish them, and even fewer are fortunate enough to have them published. And so I think that when you hold your book for the first time, it's such an incredible, tangible proof of what you've achieved. It was a really special moment.
It certainly sounds it. So are you into mantras at all? How do you live your life?
I don't have any mantras. No, I constantly want to try things like mindfulness and constantly fail. Although I'm told that that's okay, that it's okay to let your mind wander off, that the idea is you recognize it and you bring it back. I'd like to be the sort of person who starts the day with yoga and freshly squeezed wheatgrass. But I don't, and I very much doubt I will be, but I live in hope.
So how about your influences? Who's been the greatest influence in your life?
My parents were, I think that what my parents gave me that shaped my entire life was the belief that I could do anything I wanted to, and not in a sort of pushy parent, not in a sort of an unrealistic way. You know, if I said to my parents I'd quite like to be a rocket scientist, they'd probably gently remind me about the struggles I had with GCSE maths and physics, and that maybe my talents lie elsewhere. But if something is within my power, then I firmly believe I can do it. We have a real problem in this world with creative industries. Striving to be something that is creative is seen as much more difficult than becoming a teacher or an accountant. And yet, I think if you want to be an artist, if you want to be an author, a sculptor, there is a path that you can take that's no different from the path that you would take to be a teacher or an accountant. And so I think you follow that and you work towards your aim. And so that was just the way that I was brought up, that you just having that confidence. So that was a huge influence in my life. Nowadays, I have friends that I really trust, and I really value their advice and their wisdom. And I've started writing letters, something I did towards the start of this year, rather than emailing or Facebooking or tweeting or any of those methods. And it's interesting, the wisdom and the advice that's translated in letter form that feels slightly different to when you're talking face to face or you phone someone. And so I keep those letters and I return to them, and I find them very inspiring.
So what's your next goal? You've got a new book out in 2018, Let Me Lie. Any insights in that?
So Let Me Lie is another standalone psychological thriller. It's about a new mother, Anna, whose parents committed suicide the year previously. And she has always struggled to comprehend why her parents would do that. And so she sets out to dig into the past and find out what really happened, but somebody wants to stop her.
Gosh, we're looking forward to that already. Now, we have some male listeners too that we appreciate. So do you have any insights that you'd give them to help them and help women juggling their careers and families?
Well, do you know what? I hate the idea that we're divided like this, that men need to step up to the plate and help women who are juggling, because everyone's setup is different. Everyone's family is different. In my family, I'm the one who is constantly on an aeroplane traveling or shut away in my office writing. And it's my husband who's picking the kids up, cooking supper. When he goes away, which is rare, I have to ask him, you know, when's George's guitar lesson and how much money do I need for swimming? So everyone's different. I think that all of us need to talk more. We're all very, very bad at actually saying what we mean. We're fond of the off-the-cuff comments and the sort of, you know, slightly passive-aggressive remarks about folding the socks. So I think we all need to talk more. And I think it's good to talk not just about the here and now, but about the future, and to really tell each other where we want to be in 5 years' time. And if you've got an incredible career goal, how does that fit with your other half's career goal? How are you going to make them dovetail together so that you both get what you want, but not at anyone else's cost? This is a slightly odd example, but I was talking to Richard and Judy, who of course have their amazing book club, and they are both writers, and they have their books out in opposite years. And Richard was talking about this and explaining it, that firstly, they don't want to be in direct competition with each other, because that's not a great thing for their relationship. But also it enables each of them to support the other one. And so Rich is writing his book, Judy's supporting him, he's going on tour, she's going with him and supporting him. And then the next year the tables turn and he's the one supporting her. And I think it's just a really good, simple way of approaching things, that whether or not you've got two of you at home who are both working full time, or you're working, one of you's part time, or perhaps one of you's at home all the time, that doesn't mean that there aren't things you want to do. And so, you know, you take it in turns, don't you? Whether you're taking the dishes in turn, or whether it's, well, this year's really important at work, I'm really going to focus on it, and the other one's going to be there supporting in the wings. But, you know, your time will turn.
You've got some great practical solutions for modern life there. So lastly, what message would you give to inspire and influence people living out there?
I think that we all have an influence. So I'm a big believer in something called the sphere of influence, which you will know all about. So you imagine a series of circles, one inside the other, like Russian dolls, I suppose. And you're right in the middle, and you can only really directly influence the circle immediately outside of yours. The circles that carry on after that, you know, you might have friends, and then you might have colleagues, and then you might have community, and then you've got the world, and outside of that you've got Trump and, you know, all sorts of things. If you focus on that outside circle that you cannot directly influence, you will become frustrated and unhappy. That's not to say you can't do things that have an effect, but it's a ripple effect, it's not a direct influence. And so I think it's important to work out what is within your sphere of influence. What can you have a direct effect on? Your happiness, your health, your well-being, that of your family and the people directly around you. Focus on that and see the tangible effects that your influence can have.
Well, you see, that was fantastic. Anything else you want to add?
No, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. You are one seriously inspiring lady. I think it's that police force and that author combined is just unique. Good luck with your current and future books. Thank you and Little Brown Books. And thank you to you, Claire McIntosh, for sharing your bravery, your insight, your vision, your personal experiences and your time to help influence other men and women today for tomorrow. This influential women's podcast is presented by Nikki Bannerman and co-produced with Juliet Nichols. Please keep listening for more podcasts and subscribe free on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. And please review and share us online to influence other men and women to download, listen, and subscribe to our podcast.